little value-laden narratives, one after the other, from now until eternity. These narratives we invent for ourselves around what's important and what's not, what is deserving and what is not. These stories stick with us and define us. They determine how we fit ourselves into the world and with each other. They determine how we feel about ourselves, whether we deserve a good life or not, whether we deserve to be loved or not, whether we deserve success or not, and they define what we know and understand about ourselves. This network of value-based narratives is our identity. When you think to yourself, "I'm a pretty badass boat captain, hardy har," that is a narrative you've constructed to define yourself and to know yourself. It's a component of your walking, talking self that you introduce to others and plaster all over your Facebook page. You captain boats, and you do it damn well, and therefore you deserve good things. But here's the funny thing. When you adopt these little narratives as your identity, you protect them and react emotionally to them as though they were an inherent part of you. The same way that getting punched will cause a violent emotional reaction, someone coming up and saying you're a shitty boat captain will produce a similarly negative emotional reaction, because we react to protect the metaphysical body just as we protect the physical. Our identities snowball through our lives, accumulating more and more values and meaning as they tumble along. You were close with your mom growing up, and that relationship brings you hope. So you construct a story in your mind that comes to partly define you, just as your thick hair or your brown eyes or your creepy toenails define you. Your mom is a huge part of your life. Your mom is an amazing woman. You owe everything to your mom. And other shit people say at the Academy Awards. You then protect that piece of your identity as if it were a part of you. Someone comes along and talks shit about your mom, and you absolutely lose your mind and start breaking things. Then that experience creates a new narrative and a new value in your mind. You decide, have anger issues, especially around your mother. And now that becomes an inherent part of your identity. And on it goes. The longer we've held a value, the deeper inside the snowball it is, and the more fundamental it is to how we see ourselves and how we see the world. Like interest on a bank loan, our values compound over time, growing stronger and coloring future experiences. It's not just the bullying from when you were in grade school that fucks you up. It's the bullying plus all the self-loathing and narcissism you brought to decades worth of future relationships, causing them all to fail, that adds up over time. Psychologists don't know much for certain, but one thing they definitely do know is that childhood trauma fucks us up. This snowball effect of early values is why our childhood experiences, both good and bad, have long-lasting effects on our identities and generate the fundamental values that go on to define much of our lives. Your early experiences become your core values. And if your core values are fucked up, they create a domino effect of suckage that extends through the years, infecting experiences large and small with their toxicity. When we're young, we have tiny and fragile identities. We've experienced little. We're completely dependent on our caretakers for everything, and inevitably, they're going to mess it up. Neglects or harm can cause extreme emotional reactions, resulting in large moral gaps that are never equalized. Dad walks out, and your three-year-old feeling brain decides that you were never lovable in the first place. Mom abandons you for some rich new husband, and you decide that intimacy doesn't exist, that no one can ever be trusted. No wonder Newton was such a cranky loner. And the worst thing is, the longer we've held on to these narratives, the less aware we are that we have them. They become the background noise of our thoughts, the interior decoration of our minds. Despite being arbitrary and completely made up, they seem not only natural, but inevitable. The values we pick up throughout our lives crystallize and form a sediment on top of our personality. The only way to change our values is to have experiences contrary to our values, and any attempt to break free from those values through new or contrary experiences will inevitably be met with pain and discomfort. This is why there is no such thing as change without pain, no growth without discomfort. It's why it is impossible to become someone new without first grieving the loss of who you used to be. Because when we lose our values, we grieve the death of those defining narratives as though we've lost a part of ourselves. Because we have lost a part of ourselves, we grieve the same way we would grieve the loss of a loved one, the loss of a job, a house, a community, a spiritual belief, or a friendship. These are all defining fundamental parts of you, and when they are torn away from you, the hope they offered your life is also torn away, leaving you exposed, once again, to the uncomfortable truth. There are two ways to heal yourself, that is, to replace old, faulty values with better, healthier values. The first is to re-examine the experiences of your past and rewrite the narratives around them. Wait, did he punch me because I'm an awful person, or is he the awful person? Re-examining the narratives of our lives allows us to have a do-over, to decide, you know, maybe I wasn't such a great boat captain after all, and that's fine. Often, with time, we realize that what we used to believe was important about the world actually isn't. Other times, we extend the story to get a clearer view of our self-worth. Oh, she left me because some asshole left her. And she felt ashamed and unworthy around intimacy. And suddenly, that breakup is easier to swallow. The other way to change your values is to begin writing the narratives of your future self, to envision what life would be like if you had certain values or possessed a certain identity. By visualizing the future we want for ourselves, we allow our feeling brain to try on those values for size, to see what they feel like before we make the final purchase. Eventually, once we've done this enough, the feeling brain becomes accustomed to the new values and starts to believe them. This sort of future projection is usually taught in the worst of ways. Imagine you're fucking rich and own a fleet of yachts, then it will come true. Sadly, that kind of visualization is not replacing a current unhealthy value, materialism, with a better one. It's just masturbating to your current value. Real change would entail fantasizing what not wanting yachts in the first place would feel like. Fruitful visualization should be a little bit uncomfortable. It should challenge you and be difficult to fathom. If it's not, then it means that nothing is changing. The feeling brain doesn't know the difference among past, present, and future. That's the thinking brain's domain. And one of the strategies our thinking brain uses to nudge the feeling brain into the correct lane of life is asking what-if questions. What if you hated boats and instead spent your time helping disabled kids? What if you didn't have to prove anything to the people in your life for them to like you? What if people's unavailability has more to do with them than it does with you? Other times, you can just tell your feeling brain stories that might or might not be true, but that feel true. Jocko Willink, former Navy SEAL and author, writes in his book Discipline Equals Freedom, a field manual, that he wakes up at 4:30 every morning because he imagines his enemy is somewhere out there in the world. He doesn't know where, but he assumes that his enemy wants to kill him. And he realizes that if he's awake before his enemy, that gives him an advantage. Willink developed this narrative for himself while serving in the Iraq War, where there were actual enemies who did want to kill him. But he has maintained that narrative since returning to civilian life. Objectively, the narrative Willink creates for himself makes no fucking sense. Enemy? Where? But figuratively, emotionally, it is incredibly powerful. Willink's feeling brain still buys into it, and it still gets Willink up every damn morning before some of us are done drinking from the night before. That is the illusion of self-control. Without these narratives, without developing a clear vision of the future we desire, of the values we want to adopt, of the identities we want to shed or step into, we are forever doomed to repeat the failures of our past pain. The stories of our past define our identity. The stories of our future define our hopes, and our ability to step into those narratives and live them, to make them reality, is what gives our lives meaning. Emotional gravity. Emo Newton sat alone in his childhood bedroom. It was dark outside. He didn't know how long he had been awake, what time it was, or what day it was. He had been alone and working for weeks now. Food that his family had left for him sat uneaten by the door, rotting. He took out a blank piece of paper and drew a large circle on it. He then marked points along the edges of the circle, and with dotted lines indicated the pole of each dot toward the center. Beneath this, he wrote, "There is an emotional gravity to our values. We attract those into our orbit who value the same things we do, and instinctively repel, as if by reverse magnetism, those whose values are contrary to our own. These attractions form large orbits of like-minded people around the same principle. Each falls along the same path, circling and revolving around the same cherished thing." He then drew another circle, adjacent to the first. The two circles' edges nearly touched. From there, he drew lines of tension between the edges of each circle, the places where the gravity pulled in both directions, disrupting the perfect symmetry of each orbit. He then wrote, "Large swaths of people coalesce together, forming tribes and communities based on similar evaluations of their emotional histories. You, sir, may value science. I, too, value science. Therefore, there is an emotional magnetism between us. Our values attract one another and cause us to fall perpetually into each other's orbit in a metaphysical dance of friendship. Our values align and our cause becomes one. But let's say that one gentleman sees value in Puritanism and another in Anglicanism. They are inhabitants of two closely related yet different gravities. This causes each to disrupt the other's orbit, cause tension within the value hierarchies, challenge the other's identity, and thus generate negative emotions that will push them apart and put their causes at odds. This emotional gravity, I declare, is the fundamental organization of all human conflict and endeavor." At this, Isaac took out another page and drew a series of circles of differing sizes. "The stronger we hold a value," he wrote, "that is, the stronger we determine something as superior or inferior than all else, the stronger its gravity, the tighter its orbit, and the more difficult it is for outside forces to disrupt its path and purpose. Our strongest values therefore demand either the affinity or the antipathy of others. The more people there are who share some value, the more those people begin to congeal and organize themselves into a single, coherent body around that value. Scientists with scientists, clergy with clergy. People who love the same thing love each other. People who hate the same thing also love each other. And people who love or hate different things hate each other. All human systems eventually reach equilibrium by clustering and conforming into constellations of mutually shared value systems. People come together, altering and modifying their own personal narratives until their narratives are one and the same, and the personal identity thus becomes the group identity. Now, you may be saying, but my good man, Newton, don't most people value the same things? Don't most people simply want a bit of bread and a safe place to sleep at night? And to that, I say you are correct, my friend. All peoples are more the same than they are different. We all mostly want the same things out of life, but those slight differences generate emotion. An emotion generates a sense of importance. Therefore, we come to perceive our differences as disproportionately more important than our similarities. And this is the true tragedy of man, that we are doomed to perpetual conflict over the slight difference. This theory of emotional gravitation, the coherence and attraction of like values, explains the history of peoples. Different parts of the world have different geographic factors. One region may be hard and rugged and well defended from invaders. Its people would then naturally value neutrality and isolation. This would then become their group identity. Another region may overflow with food and wine, and its people would come to value hospitality, festivities, and family. This too would become their identity. Another region may be arid and a difficult place to live, but with wide open vistas connecting it to many distant lands. Its people would come to value authority, strong military leadership, and absolute dominion. This too is their identity. And just as the individual protects her identity through beliefs, rationalizations, and biases, communities, tribes, and nations protect their identities the same way. These cultures eventually solidify themselves into nations, which then expand, bringing more and more peoples into the umbrella of their value systems. Eventually, these nations will bump up against each other, and the contradictory values will collide. Most people do not value themselves above their cultural and group values. Therefore, many people are willing to die for their highest values, for their family, their loved ones, their nation, their God. And because of this willingness to die for their values, these collisions of culture will inevitably result in war. War is but a terrestrial test of hope. The country or people who have adopted values that maximize the resources and hopes of its people's best will inevitably become the victor. The more a nation conquers neighboring peoples, the more the people of that conquering nation come to feel that they deserve to dominate their fellow men, and the more they will see their nation's values as the true guiding lights of humanity. The supremacy of those winning values then lives on, and the values are written up and lauded in our histories and go on to be retold in stories, passed down to give future generations hope. Eventually, when those values cease to be effective, they will lose out to the values of another, newer nation, and history will continue on, a new era unfolding. This, I declare, is the form of human progress. Newton finished writing. He placed his theory of emotional gravitation on the same stack with his three laws of emotion, and then paused to reflect on his discoveries. And in that quiet, dark moment, Isaac Newton looked at the circles on the page and had an upsetting realization. He had no orbit. Through years of trauma and social failure, he had voluntarily separated himself from everything and everyone, like a lone star flung on its own trajectory, unobstructed and uninfluenced by the gravitational pull of any system. He realized that he valued no one, not even himself, and this brought him an overwhelming sense of loneliness and grief, because no amount of logic and calculation could ever compensate for the gnawing desperation of his feeling brain's never-ending struggle to find hope in this world. I would love to tell you that Parallel Universe Newton, or Emo Newton, overcame his sadness and solitude. I would love to tell you that he learned to value himself and others. But like our universe's Isaac Newton, Parallel Universe Newton would spend the rest of his days alone, grumpy and miserable. The questions both Newtons answered that summer of 1665 had perplexed philosophers and scientists for generations. Yet, in a matter of a few months, this cantankerous, antisocial 25-year-old had uncovered the mystery, had cracked the code. And there, on the frontiers of intellectual discovery, he tossed his findings aside to a musty and forgotten corner of a cramped study in a remote backwater village, a day's ride north of London. And there his discoveries would remain, hidden to the world, collecting dust. Chapter 4. How to Make All Your Dreams Come True. Imagine this. It's 2 a.m. and you're still awake on the couch, staring bleary-eyed and foggy-brained at the television. Why? You don't know. Inertia simply makes it easier to sit there and keep watching than to get up and go to bed. So, you watch. Perfect. This is how I get you. When you're feeling apathetic and lost and completely passive in the face of your fate, nobody sits up staring at a TV at 2 a.m. if they have important shit to do the next day. Nobody struggles with the will to move their ass off the couch for hours on end unless they're having some sort of inner crisis of hope. And it's exactly this crisis that I want to speak to. I appear on your TV screen. I'm a whirlwind of energy. There are loud, obnoxious colors, cheesy sound effects. I'm practically shouting. Yet somehow, my smile is easy and relaxed. I'm comforting. It's as though I'm making eye contact with you and only you. What if I told you I could solve all your life's problems? Please, you think. You don't know the half of my problems, buddy. What if I told you I know how to make all your dreams come true? Right, and I'm the fucking tooth fairy. Look, I know how you feel, I say. Nobody knows how I feel, you reflexively tell yourself, surprised at how automatic the response is. I, too, once felt lost, I say. I felt alone, isolated, hopeless. I, too, used to lie awake at night for no particular reason, wondering if there was something wrong with me, wondering what was this invisible force standing between myself and my dreams. And I know that's what you're feeling too, that you've somehow lost something, you just don't know what. In truth, I say these things because they are experienced by everybody. They are a fact of the human condition. We all feel powerless to equalize with the inherent guilt that comes with our existence. We all suffer and are victimized to varying degrees, especially when we're young. And we all spend a lifetime trying to compensate for that suffering. And in moments of our life when things aren't going so well, this makes us despair. But like most people struggling, you've enveloped yourself so much in your pain that you've forgotten that pain is common, and that your strife is not uniquely yours. On the contrary, it's universal. And because you've forgotten this, you feel as if I'm speaking directly to you, as if by some magical power, I'm peering into your soul and reading back to you the contents of your heart. For this, you sit up and at attention. Because, I repeat, I have the solution to all your problems. I can make all your dreams come true. Now I'm pointing, and my finger looks gigantic on your TV screen. I have all the answers. I have the secret of everlasting happiness and eternal life, and it's this. What I go on to say is so outlandish, so ridiculous, so absolutely perverse and cynical that you actually think it might be true. The problem is, you want to believe me. You need to believe me. I represent the hope and salvation your feeling brain desperately craves, that it needs. So slowly, your thinking brain comes to the conclusion that my idea is so batshit crazy that it just might work. As the infomercial drags on, that existential need to find meaning somewhere, anywhere, beats down your psychological defenses and lets me in. After all, I have demonstrated an uncanny knowledge of your pain, a backdoor entrance to your secret truth, a deep vein traveling through your heart. You then realize that in between all my big white teeth and shouty words, I've spoken to you. I was once just as fucked as you, and I found my way out. Come with me. I keep going. I'm on a roll now. The camera angles are switching back and forth, grabbing me now from the side, now from the front. Suddenly there's a studio audience in front of me. They're wrapped up in every word I say. A woman is crying, a man's jaw drops, and yours drops with it. I'm all up in your shit now. I will give you permanent fulfillment, motherfucker. I will fill any gap, plug any hole. Just sign up for one low price. What is happiness worth to you? What is hope worth to you? Act now, fucker. Sign up. Today. With that, you grab your phone. You go to the website. You put in the digits. Truth and salvation and everlasting happiness, it's all yours. It's coming to you. Are you ready? How to start your own religion. An introduction to a proven system that will help you achieve everlasting bliss and eternal salvation. Or your money back. Welcome and congratulations on taking the first step to making all your dreams come true. By the end of this course, you will solve all your life's problems. You will live a life of abundance and freedom. You will be surrounded by adoring friends and loved ones. Guaranteed. Terms and conditions may apply. It's so simple, anyone can do it. No education or certification required. All you need is an internet connection and a functioning keyboard. And you, too, can create your very own religion. Yes, you heard me right. You, too, can start your very own religion. Today! And begin reaping the benefits of the thousands of mindlessly devoted followers who will lavish on you unconditional adoration, financial gifts, and more social media likes than you know what to do with. In this So Simple Anyone Can Do It 6-step program, we will cover belief systems. Do you want your religion to be spiritual or secular? Past-focused or future-focused? Do you want it to be violent or nonviolent? These are all important questions. But don't worry, only I have the answers. How to find your first followers? And more important, what do you want your followers to be? Rich? Poor? Male? Female? Vegan? I have the inside scoop. Rituals, rituals, rituals. Eat this, stand there, recite that. Bow and kneel and clap your hands. do the hokey pokey and turn yourself around. That's what it's all about. The most enjoyable part of religion is coming up with dumb stuff that you all agree somehow means something. I will provide you with a complete guide to developing the hippest, coolest rituals on the block. All the kids will be talking about it, mainly because they'll be forced to. How to choose a scapegoat. No religion is complete without a common enemy upon which to project one's inner turmoil. Life is messy, but why deal with your problems when you can just blame somebody else for them? That's right, you'll discover the best way to choose an evil boogeyman or boogeywoman, and how to convince your followers to hate him or her. Nothing unites us like hating the same enemy. Get your assault rifles ready. And finally, how to make money. Why start a religion if you don't profit from it? My guide will give you all the nitty-gritty details on how to milk the most out of your followers. Whether you're into money, fame, political power, or blood orgies, I've got you covered. Look, we all need communities to build hope. And we all need hope to not go utterly fucking insane and start snorting bath salts. Religions are the basis for that communal hope, and we're going to learn how to build them from scratch. Religions are a beautiful thing. When you get enough people together with the same values, they behave in ways they never would when alone. Their hope amplifies in a sort of network effect, and the social validation of being part of a group hijacks their thinking brains and lets their feeling brains run wild. Religions bring groups of people together to mutually validate one another and make one another feel important. It's a big silent agreement that if we all come together under some shared purpose, we will feel important and worthy, and the uncomfortable truth will be just that much farther away. This is hugely satisfying psychologically. People just lose their shit. And best of all, they become highly suggestible. Paradoxically, it's only in a group environment that the individual has no control that he gains the perception of perfect self-control. The danger of this immediate access to the feeling brain, though, is that large groups of people tend to do highly impulsive and irrational shit. So on the one hand, people get to feel whole, like they're understood and loved. On the other hand, they sometimes transform into murderous, angry mobs. This guide will take you through the details of establishing your own religion, so you can reap the benefits of thousands of suggestible followers. So let's get started. How to start your own religion. Step 1. Sell hope to the hopeless. I'll never forget the first time someone told me I had blood on my hands. I remember it as if it were yesterday. It was 2005, a sunny, crisp morning in Boston, Massachusetts. I was a university student then and walking to class, minding my own business, when I saw a group of kids holding up pictures of the 9/11 terrorist attacks with captions that read, "America deserved it." Now, I don't consider myself the most patriotic person by any stretch of the imagination, but it seems to me that anyone holding such a sign in broad daylight immediately becomes a highly punchable person. I stopped and engaged the kids, asking what they were doing. They had a little table set up, with a smattering of pamphlets on top. One had Dick Cheney with devil's horns drawn on him, and the words "mass murderer" written beneath. Another had George W. Bush with a Hitler mustache. The students were part of the LaRouche Youth Movement, a group started by the far-left ideologue Lyndon LaRouche in New Hampshire. His acolytes would spend countless hours standing around college campuses in the Northeast, handing out flyers and pamphlets to susceptible college kids. And when I came upon them, it took me all of 10 seconds to figure out what they actually were. A religion. That's right. They were an ideological religion. An anti-government, anti-capitalist, anti-old people, anti-establishment religion. They argued that the international world order, from top to bottom, was corrupt. They argued that the Iraq War had been instigated for no other reason than that Bush's friends wanted more money. They argued that terrorism and mass shootings didn't exist, that such events were simply highly coordinated governmental efforts to control the population. Don't worry, right-wing friends. Years later, they would draw the same Hitler mustaches and make the same claims about Obama. If that makes you feel any better, it shouldn't. What the LaRouche Youth Movement does is pure genius. It finds disaffected and agitated college students, usually young men, kids who are both scared and angry, scared at the sudden responsibility they've been forced to take on, and angry at how uncompromising and disappointing it is to be an adult, and then preach one simple message to them. It's not your fault. Yes, young one, you thought it was mom and dad's fault, but it's not their fault. Nope. And I know you thought it was your shitty professors and overpriced college's fault. Nope, not theirs either. You probably even thought it was the government's fault. Close, but still no. See, it's the system's fault. That grand, vague entity you've always heard about. This was the faith that the LaRouche youth movement was selling. If we could just overthrow the system, then everything would be okay. No more war, no more suffering, no more injustice. Remember that in order to feel hope, we need to feel there's a better future out there. Values. We need to feel as though we're capable of getting to that better future. Self-control. And we need to find other people who share our values and support our efforts. Community. Young adulthood is a period when many people struggle with values, control, and community. For the first time in their lives, kids are allowed to decide who they want to be. Do they want to become a doctor, study business, take a psychology course? The options can be crippling. And the inevitable frustration causes a lot of young people to question their values and lose hope. In addition, young adults struggle with self-control. For the first time in their lives, they don't have some authority figure watching over them 24/7. On the one hand, this can be liberating, exciting. On the other, they are now responsible for their own decisions. And if they kind of suck at getting themselves out of bed on time, going to their classes or a job, and studying enough, it's tough to admit that there's no one to blame but themselves. And finally, young people are particularly preoccupied with finding and fitting into a community. Not only is this important for their emotional development, but it also helps them find and solidify an identity for themselves. People such as Lyndon LaRouche capitalize on lost and aimless young people like this. He gives them a convoluted political explanation to justify how disaffected they feel. He gives them a sense of control and empowerment by outlining a way, supposedly, to change the world. And finally, he gives them a community where they fit in and know who they are. Therefore, he gives them hope. Don't you think this is taking it a little too far? I asked the LaRouche movement students that day, pointing to the pictures of the World Trade Center towers featured on their pamphlets. No way, man. I say we're not taking it far enough, one of the kids replied. Look, I didn't vote for Bush, and I don't agree with the Iraq war either, but it doesn't matter who you vote for. A vote for anyone is a vote for the corrupt and oppressive system. You have blood on your hands. Excuse me? I didn't even know how to punch someone, yet I found myself balling my hands in the fists. Who the fuck did this guy think he was? By participating in the system, you are perpetuating it, the kid continued, and therefore are complicit in the murder of millions of innocent civilians around the world. Here, read this. He shoved a pamphlet at me. I glanced at it, turned it over. That's fucking stupid, I said. Our discussion went on like this for another few minutes. Back then, I didn't know any better. I still thought stuff like this was about reason and evidence, not feelings and values. And values cannot be changed through reason, only through experience. Eventually, after I had gotten good and pissed off, I decided to leave. As I started walking off, the kid tried to get me to sign up for a free seminar. You need to have an open mind, man, he said. The truth is scary. And I replied by shouting as I walked away, a Carl Sagan quote I had once read on an internet forum. I think your mind is so open your brain fell out. I felt smart and smug. He presumably felt smart and smug. No minds were changed that day. We are the most impressionable when things are at their worst. When our life is falling apart, it signifies that our values have failed us, and we're grasping in the dark for new values to replace them. One religion falls and opens up space for the next. People who lose faith in their spiritual God will look for a worldly God. People who lose their family will give themselves away to their race, creed, or nation. People who lose faith in their government or country will look to extremist ideologies to give them hope. There's a reason that all major religions in the world have a history of sending missionaries to the poorest and most destitute corners of the globe. Starving people will believe anything if it will keep them fed. For your new religion, it's best to start preaching your message to people whose lives suck the most. The poor, the outcasts, the abused and forgotten. You know, people who sit on Facebook all day. Jim Jones built his following by recruiting the homeless and marginalized minorities with a socialist message minced with his own demented take on Christianity. Hell, what am I saying? Jesus Christ did the same damn thing. Buddha, too. Moses, you get the idea. Religious leaders preached to the poor and downtrodden and enslaved, telling them that they deserved the kingdom of heaven. Basically an open fuck you to the corrupt elites of the day. It's a message that's easy to get behind. Today, appealing to the hopeless is easier than ever before. All you need is a social media account. Start posting extreme and crazy shit, and let the algorithms do the rest. The crazier and more extreme your posts, the more attention you'll garner, and the more the hopeless will flock to you, like flies to cow shit. It's not hard at all. But you can't just go online and say anything. No, you must have a semi-coherent message. You must have a vision. Because it's easy to get people riled up and angry about nothing. The news media have created a whole business model out of it. But to have hope, people need to feel that they are part of some greater movement, that they are about to join the winning side of history. And for that, you must give them faith. How to start your own religion. Step 2. Choose your faith. We must all have faith in something. Without faith, there is no hope. Non-religious people bristle at the word faith, but having faith is inevitable. Evidence and science are based on past experience. Hope is based on future experience. And you must always rely on some degree of faith that something will occur again in the future. You pay your mortgage because you have faith that money is real, and credit is real, and a bank taking all your shit is real. You tell your kids to do their homework, because you have faith that their education is important, that it will lead them to their becoming happier, healthier adults. You have faith that happiness exists and is possible. You have faith that living longer is worth it, so you strive to stay safe and healthy. You have faith that love matters, that your job matters, that any of this matters. So, there's no such thing as an atheist. Well, sorta. Depends what you mean by atheist. My point is that we must all believe, on faith, that something is important. Even if you're a nihilist, you are believing, on faith, that nothing is more important than anything else. So in the end, it's all faith. The important question, then, is faith in what? What do we choose to believe? Whatever our feeling brain adopts as its highest value, this tippy top of our value hierarchy becomes the lens through which we interpret all other values. Let's call this highest value the God value. Some people's God value is money. These people view all other things, family, love, prestige, politics, through the prism of money. Their family will love them only if they make enough money. They will be respected only if they have money. All conflict, frustration, jealousy, anxiety, everything boils down to money. Other people's God value is love. They view all other values through the prism of love. They're against conflict in all its forms. They're against anything that separates or divides others. Obviously, many people adopt Jesus Christ, or Muhammad, or the Buddha as their God value. They then interpret everything they experience through the prism of that spiritual leader's teachings. Some people's God value is themselves, or rather, their own pleasure and empowerment. This is narcissism, the religion of self-aggrandizement. These people place their faith in their own superiority and deservedness. Other people's God value is another person. This is often called codependence. These people derive all hope from their connection with another individual and sacrifice themselves and their own interests for that individual. They then base all their behavior, decisions, and beliefs on what they think will please that other person, their own little personal God. This typically leads to really fucked up relationships with You guessed it, narcissist. After all, the narcissist god value is himself, and the codependent's god value is fixing and saving the narcissist. So it kind of works out in a really sick and fucked up way. But not really. All religions must start with a faith-based god value. Doesn't matter what it is. Worshipping cats, believing in lower taxes, never letting your kids leave the house. Whatever it is a faith-based value that this one thing will produce the best future reality, and therefore gives the most hope. We then organize our lives and all other values around that value. We look for activities that enact that faith, ideas that support it, and most important, communities that share it. It's around now that some of the more scientifically minded readers start raising their hands and pointing out that there are these things called facts, and there is ample evidence to demonstrate that facts exist, and we don't need to have faith to know that some things are real. Fair enough, but here's the thing about evidence. It changes nothing. Evidence belongs to the thinking brain, whereas values are decided by the feeling brain. You cannot verify values. They are, by definition, subjective and arbitrary. Therefore, you can argue about facts until you're blue in the face, but ultimately, it doesn't matter. People interpret the significance of their experiences through their values. If a meteorite hit a town and killed half the people, the uber-traditional religious person would look at the event and say that it happened because the town was full of sinners. The atheist would look at it and say that it was proof that there is no God. Another faith-based belief, by the way. As how could a benevolent, all-powerful being let such an awful thing happen? A hedonist would look at it and decide that it was even more reason to party, since we could all die at any moment. And a capitalist would look at it and start thinking about how to invest in meteorite defense technologies. Evidence serves the interests of the God value, not the other way around. The only loophole to this arrangement is when evidence itself becomes your God value. The religion built around the worship of evidence is more commonly known as science, and it's arguably the best thing we've ever done as a species. But we'll get to science and its ramifications in the next chapter. My point is that all values are faith-based beliefs. Therefore, all hope, and therefore all religions, are also based on faith. Faith that something can be important and valuable and right, despite the fact that there will never be a way to verify it beyond all doubt. For our purposes, I've defined three types of religions, each type based on a different kind of God value. Spiritual religions. Spiritual religions draw hope from supernatural beliefs, or belief in things that exist outside the physical or material realm. These religions look for a better future outside this world and this life. Christianity, Islam, Judaism, animism, and Greek mythology are examples of spiritual religions. Ideological religions. Ideological religions draw hope from the natural world. They look for salvation and growth and develop faith-based beliefs regarding this world and this life. Examples include capitalism, communism, environmentalism, liberalism, fascism, and libertarianism. Interpersonal religions. Interpersonal religions draw hope from other people in our lives. Examples of interpersonal religions include romantic love, children, sports heroes, political leaders, and celebrities. Spiritual religions are high risk, high reward. They require, by far, the most skill and charisma to get going. But they also pay off the most in terms of follower loyalty and benefits. I mean, have you seen the Vatican? Holy shit. And if you build one really well, it'll last way after you die. Ideological religions play the religion formation game on normal difficulty. These religions take a lot of work and effort to create, but they're fairly common. But because they're so common, they run into a lot of competition for people's hopes. They are often described as cultural trends, and indeed, few of them survive more than a few years or decades. Only the best last through multiple centuries. Finally, interpersonal religions are playing the religion formation game on easy mode. That's because interpersonal religions are as common as people themselves. Pretty much all of us, at some point in our lives, completely surrender ourselves and our self-worth to another individual. The interpersonal religion is sometimes experienced as an adolescent, naive sort of love, and it's the type of shit that you have to suffer through before you can ever grow out of it. Let's start with spiritual religions, as they have the highest stakes and are arguably the most important religions in human history. Spiritual religions. From the pagan and animalistic rituals of early human cultures, to the pagan gods of antiquity, to the grandiose monotheistic religions that still exist today, the majority of human history has been dominated by a belief in supernatural forces, and most important, the hope that certain actions and beliefs in this life would lead to rewards and improvement in the next life. This preoccupation with the next life developed because for most of human history, everything was completely fucked, and 99% of the population had no hope of material or physical improvement in their lives. If you think things are bad today, just think about the plagues that wiped out a third of the population on an entire continent, or the wars that involved selling tens of thousands of children into slavery. In fact, things were so bad in the old days that the only way to keep everyone sane was by promising them hope in an afterlife. Old school religion held the fabric of society together because it gave the masses a guarantee that their suffering was meaningful, that God was watching, and that they would be duly rewarded. In case you haven't noticed, spiritual religions are incredibly resilient. They last hundreds, if not thousands, of years. This is because supernatural beliefs can never be proven or disproven. Therefore, once a supernatural belief gets lodged as someone's God value, it's nearly impossible to dislodge it. Spiritual religions are also powerful because they often encourage hope through death, which has the nice side effect of making a lot of people willing to die for their unverifiable beliefs. Hard to compete with that. Ideological religions. Ideological religions generate hope by constructing networks of beliefs that certain actions will produce better outcomes in this life, only if they are adopted by the population at large. Ideologies are usually isms, libertarianism, nationalism, materialism, racism, sexism, veganism, communism, capitalism, socialism, fascism, cynicism, skepticism, etc. Unlike spiritual religions, ideologies are verifiable to varying degrees. You can theoretically test to see whether a central bank makes a financial system more or less stable, whether democracy makes society fairer, whether education makes people hack one another to pieces less often. But at a certain point, most ideologies still rely on faith. There are two reasons for this. The first is that some things are just incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to test and verify. The other is that a lot of ideologies rely upon everyone in society having faith in the same thing. For instance, you can't scientifically prove that money is intrinsically valuable, but we all believe it is, so it is. You also can't prove that national citizenship is a real thing, or even that most ethnicities exist. These are all socially constructed beliefs that we've all bought into, taking on faith. The problem with evidence and ideologies is that humans have a tendency to take a little bit of evidence and run with it, generalizing a couple of simple ideas to entire populations and the planet. This is our human narcissism at work, our need to invent our self-importance, our feeling brain run amok. So even though ideologies are subject to evidence and verification, we're not exactly good at verifying them. Humanity is so vast and complex that our brains have trouble taking it all in. There are too many variables, so our thinking brains inevitably take shortcuts to maintain some otherwise shitty beliefs. Bad ideologies such as racism or sexism persist due to ignorance far more than malice, and people hold on to those bad ideologies because, sadly, they offer their adherents some degree of hope. Ideological religions are difficult to start, but they are far more common than spiritual religions. All you have to do is find some reasonable-sounding explanation for why everything is fucked, and then extrapolate that across wide populations in a way that gives people some hope. And voila, you have yourself an ideological religion. If you've been alive for more than 20 years, surely you've seen this happen a few times by now. In my lifetime alone, there have been movements in favor of LGBTQ rights, stem cell research, and decriminalizing drug use. In fact, a lot of what everyone is losing their shit about today is the fact that traditionalist, nationalist, and populist ideologies are winning political power across much of the world, and these ideologies are seeking to dismantle much of the work accomplished by the neoliberal, globalist, feminist, and environmentalist ideologies of the late 20th century. Interpersonal religions. Every Sunday, millions of people come together to stare at an empty green field. The field has white lines painted on it. These millions of people have all agreed to believe, on faith, that these lines mean something important. Then, dozens of strong men or women plod onto the field, line up in seemingly arbitrary formations, and throw or kick around a piece of leather. Depending on where this piece of leather goes and when, one group of people cheers, and the other group of people gets really upset. Sports are a form of religion. They are arbitrary value systems designed to give people hope. Hit the ball here, and you're a hero. Kick the ball there, and you're a loser. Sports deify some individuals and demonize others. Ted Williams is the best baseball hitter ever, and therefore, according to some, an American hero, an icon, a role model. Other athletes are demonized for coming up short, for wasting their talent, for betraying their followers. Yet there is an even grander example of interpersonal religion than sports: politics. Across the world, we come together under a similar set of values and decide to bestow authority, leadership, and virtue onto a small number of people. We usually pick our leaders because they reflect our values, but the result is the same. Some people are exalted, worshipped, and praised over others. Like the lines on a football field, political systems are entirely made up. The positions of power exist due only to the faith of the population. And whether it's a democracy or a dictatorship, the result is the same. A small group of leaders is idolized and exalted, or demonized in the social consciousness. Interpersonal religions give us hope that another human being will bring us salvation and happiness, that one individual or group of individuals is superior to all others. Interpersonal religions are sometimes combined with supernatural beliefs and ideological beliefs, resulting in pariahs, martyrs, heroes, and saints. Many of our interpersonal religions develop around our leaders, a charismatic president or celebrity who seems to understand everything we go through, can approach the level of a God value in our eyes, and much of what we deem right or wrong is filtered through what is good or bad for our dear leader. Fandom, in general, is a low-level kind of religion. Fans of Will Smith or Katy Perry or Elon Musk follow everything that person does, hang on every word he or she says, and come to see him or her as blessed or righteous in some way. The worship of that figure gives the fan hope of a better future, even if it's in the form of something as simple as future films, songs, or inventions. But the most important interpersonal religions are our familial and romantic relationships. The beliefs and emotions involved in these relationships are evolutionary in nature, but they are faith-based all the same. Each family is its own mini-church, a group of people who, on faith, believe that being a part of the group will give their lives meaning, hope, and salvation. Romantic love, of course, can be a quasi-spiritual experience. We seem to lose ourselves in someone we have fallen for, spinning all sorts of narratives about the cosmic significance of the relationship. For better or worse, modern civilization has largely alienated us from these small interpersonal religions and tribes and replaced them with large nationalist and internationalist ideological religions. This is good news for you and me, fellow religion builder, as we don't have as many intimate bonds to cut through to get our followers emotionally attached to us, because, as we'll see, religion is all about the emotional attachments, and the best way to build those attachments is to get people to stop thinking critically. How to start your own religion. Step 3. Preemptively invalidate all criticism or outside questioning. Now that your fledgling religion has its core tenets of faith, you need to find a way to protect that faith from the inevitable criticism that will be flung its way. The trick is to adopt a belief that creates a self-reinforcing us-versus-them dichotomy. That is, create a perception of us versus them in such a way that anyone who criticizes or questions us immediately becomes a them. This sounds difficult, but is actually quite easy. Here are some examples. If you don't support the war, then you support the terrorists. God created science to test our faith in God. Therefore, anything that contradicts the Bible is merely a test of our faith in God. Anyone who criticizes feminism is sexist. Anyone who criticizes capitalism is a communist. Anyone who criticizes the president is a traitor. Anyone who thinks Kobe Bryant was better than Michael Jordan is really bad at basketball. Therefore, any opinion they hold about basketball is invalid. The point of these false us versus them dichotomies is to cut off at the knees any reasoning or discussion before your followers start questioning their beliefs. These false us versus them dichotomies have the added benefit of always presenting the group with a common enemy. Common enemies are hugely important. I know we all like to think that we'd prefer to live in a world of perfect peace and harmony, but honestly, such a world wouldn't last for more than a few minutes. Common enemies create unity within our religion. Some sort of scapegoat, whether justified or not, is necessary to blame for our pain and maintain our hope. Us versus them dichotomies give us the enemies we all desperately crave. After all, you need to be able to paint a really simple picture for your followers. There are those who get it and those who do not get it. Those who get it are going to save the world. Those who do not get it are going to destroy it. End of discussion. Whatever it is depends on whatever belief you're trying to sell. Jesus, Muhammad, libertarianism, gluten-free diets, intermittent fasting, sleeping in hyperbaric chambers and living off popsicles. Also, it's not enough to tell your followers that non-believers are bad. You must demonize them. They are the downfall of everything that is good and holy. They ruin everything. They are fucking evil. You must then convince your followers that it is of the utmost importance that everyone who does not get it be stopped, no matter what. People are either near the top of the value hierarchy or at the bottom. There are no in-betweeners in our religion. The more fear, the better. Lie a little bit if you have to. Remember, people instinctually want to feel as though they're fighting a crusade, to believe that they are the holy warriors of justice and truth and salvation. So, say whatever you need to say. Get them to feel that self-righteousness to keep the religion going. This is where conspiracy theories come in handy. It's not just that vaccines cause autism. It's that the medical and pharmaceutical industries are getting rich by destroying everyone's families. It's not just that pro-choicers have a different view on the biological status of a fetus. It's that they're soldiers sent by Satan to destroy good Christian families. It's not just that climate change is a hoax. It's that it's a hoax created by the Chinese government to slow the U.S. economy and take over the world. How to start your own religion. Step 4. Ritual sacrifice for dummies. So easy, anyone can do it. Growing up in Texas, Jesus and football were the only gods that mattered. And while I learned to enjoy football despite being terrible at it, the whole Jesus thing never made a lot of sense to me. Jesus was alive, but then he died, but then he was alive again, then he died again, and he was a man, but he was also God, and now he's a kind of man-God-spirit thing that loves everyone eternally, except maybe gay people, depending on who you ask. It all struck me as kind of arbitrary, and I felt, how do I say this? Like people were just making shit up. Don't get me wrong, I could get behind most of the moral teachings of Christ. Be nice and love your neighbor and all that stuff. Youth groups were actually a ton of fun. Jesus camp is maybe the most underrated summer activity of all time. And the church usually had free cookies hiding somewhere, in some room, every Sunday morning, which when you're a kid, is exciting. But if I'm being totally honest, I didn't like being a Christian. And I didn't like it for a really dumb reason. My parents made me wear lame dress clothes. That's right, I questioned my family's faith and went atheist at age 12 over kiddie suspenders and bow ties. I remember asking my dad, if God already knows everything and loves me no matter what, why does he care what I wear on Sundays? Dad would shush me. But Dad,